Now, for those of you who weren't here last week, let me review just briefly the process of these lectures so far. What we have done, essentially, what I've done, essentially, is looked at the issue of death and dying, and looked at it especially from the point of view of the Christian perspective of Lent and why Jesus had to die on a cross, and what was there in the nature of death that made death the choice of God Almighty in His divine plan. In other words, what is there in the nature of death as death that made that the most appropriate vehicle for salvation? To me, that's one of the most profound and heavy philosophical questions. I'll really be dealing with that in 2 weeks. What I've talked about is our denials of death and the whole issue of denial and what denial is about, all the ways that we deny death, subtle and not so subtle, and that the denial of death is a fairly human, universal phenomena, because what it deals with is the undercurrent of fear, the fears that we have of death. And so we talked about our fears of death, and what's in it for you and me in this series is looking at this, looking at our fears of death, getting through our denial so that we can look at our fears, because it is in looking at the fears of death, and this is what I tried to postulate last week, that we can see our fears about life. Now let me take a few minutes and explain that. The fear of death is the fear of life as we know it, because death does not exist from an epistemological point of view. Now, what I mean by that is that death can have no meaning to anyone since no one has died. No one has an experience to go with the word. For a word to make sense, you have to have some kind of sensory experience to go with it. If I talked to you about the transcendental unity of apperception and told you that that's really what death was about, For those of you who have not read Immanuel Kant and haven't dealt with the Critique of Pure Reason, that makes no sense. The best you can do with the words transcendental unity of apperception is possibly to picture the letters of the words or the spelling of the words or to make a picture of the words. Now, by the way, if you haven't read Kant, that's good. I'd wonder about you if you had. But words, to make sense, you have to have some kind of sensory-based experience. For example, I can remember years ago a friend of mine in AA named Lovable Red, whose dog died, and he was weeping about the dog. And I can remember thinking to myself, well, God, isn't this weird, weeping about a dog? Because for me, I had never owned a dog. The only experience I'd ever had with dogs was, in relation to dogs, was that I was a paper boy. Now, paper boys don't like dogs. Dogs are paper boys' enemies. And the other experience I had was working in Butera's food market years ago, the old Butera's over on Driscoll, and I was a checker and a stock boy, and this lady used to come in the store, and I kind of thought she was dingy. And she would come up to me and she would ask me to get her cases of parred dog food. And I remember specifically this one day, her asking me to carry this huge case of dog food 2 blocks to her house. And all the way to her house, she whispered. And when we got in the house, out marched this little tiny Pekingese with little pink ribbons in her ears. And the lady whispered to me, "It's her birthday." So all this whispering had been about the dog's birthday. And I thought, boy, this is really something. Dog owners are really weird. So you see, that word could have no meaning to me. It could have no more meaning to me than my sensory experience that went with it. And what's so hard for us all to understand is that what happens with words is that we go to our sensory experience of the word. A big problem in communication is that I can't always assume that when you say a word, or that you can't always assume that when I say a word that you know what it means, nor can I assume I know what your word means. I tell the story of a lady coming into my office, and she was trembling. She was terrified. And I made the quick sort of intuitive judgment that she needed kinesthetic. She needed to be held. So I went over and put my arm around her, and she quietened down, and we talked, and I talked about how I was afraid, and how a lot of people I knew were afraid. And all of a sudden, she said something like, "Well, if they just weren't everywhere." And I sort of moved away real quick, because it dawned on me that I'd been talking to this lady for 30 minutes about her being afraid, trying to minister to her, but I didn't know what she was afraid of. I really didn't know what she was afraid of. So in other words, the experience that goes with the words is what's important. And words don't make any sense unless we have an experience that goes with them. Now, some years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, I bought my son John a dog, a beautiful little Shetland sheepdog, a Sheltie. And, this dog is just wonderful. I just love the dog, and the dog loves, when I come in the house, the dog jumps up about 2 feet off the ground, and frequently he tinkles on himself. And, I've never had a friend do that when they met me. But this dog will do it almost every time. And, Lord, I can even walk through the house and walk out the back door and come back in the front door, and the dog will do it again. In fact, it's the closest thing to unconditional love that I know. So, truly, what I now have is an experience of the unconditional faithfulness of a dog, of why dogs are called man's best friend. And I can understand how somebody could weep for that dog. Now, that's a long aside, but it's an important one, because when we come to a word like death, what experience does anybody have to go with that word? Now, we have a lot of experience of dying. We have all been through a process of dying. We have all been through many dyings. Stanley Kellerman's wonderful book, Living Your Dying, he really makes this point well, that we know about dying because we've been dying for years. The cells in my body have probably gone through 7 cycles of dying, and or the cells in my body aren't the same cells I had 10 years ago. I once lived in a womb, my mother's womb. It was a very limited world. It was a very safe world of amniotic fluid and symbiotic existence. And one day I was called to leave that world. I was called to go down the birth canal. And I was called to be born into a world. I had to leave the safety and the security of that womb. I had to die to that world to enlarge my life and to enlarge my freedom. And had I not been willing to die, go through that birth canal, go through that birthing with the pain that went with it, I couldn't have grown. I couldn't have been born to a larger existence and a larger life. So, and then being an infant and being dependent on my mother in that oral and carpentive stage where the whole world was sucking and taking in through the mouth. And I wasn't aware of anyone else's existence but my own. And then as I moved into toddlerhood, the terrible twos, the learning to control my muscles by holding on and letting go, learning to control the sphincter muscle, learning to control my hand muscles and my mouth muscles, spitting and holding juice in my mouth. All of that holding on and letting go was a very important balancing. But I had to leave the oral and carpentive, the stage of taking everything through my mouth. I had to develop my muscles to learn to explore the world. I had to leave my mother's breast. I had to die to that kind of existence. And then then I was born to a world of imagination and imaginative play and imaginative playmates, and I left the simple world of musculature, of holding on, of letting go, of exploring. I had to go into sexual identification and weaning from my mother. And then one day I had to go to school. And that was a very drastic kind of dying. I had to leave the security where I was just the wonderful little kid, where my little shoes had been cast in bronze and they had my picture on the mantelpiece. And I went to school where, you know, one of those early teachers didn't like me. And I had to adapt, and there were other kids there, and I had to try to get in with those kids and face that peer group pressure. It was a whole new world, but it was a world that if I wanted to grow, if I wanted to live and become more, I had to make those social adaptations and those social adjustments. And without those social adjustments, I just couldn't go on. So then there was high school, where I started off as nothing. I was the freshman, and the seniors were tough and mean, and they razzed and hazed us, and had to go through all the pain of finally becoming a senior. And then graduation. I'll never forget my graduation down here at the Coliseum, and walking up on that stage with cap and gown, and yet that was the high moment, and yet the very next day it was like a world had ended. Some of those people I have never seen again to this very day, that were so close, that were my friends. And then I went to college, and I was again the freshman, and I was nothing, and I had to go through the summer of 42, and I had to finally graduate from college, and then I left that world of academic security and excitement and philosophizing and idealizing. And then I had to make my way through the 20s, and then I had to die to the 20s and be born to the 30s and all the developmental tasks of the 30s, and then the 40s, and then the 50s. And so all through life's way, then there is the process of dying, there is the process of being born again, there is the process of grieving. And so we have to grieve, we have to die to be born, and we know about that. But what we don't know about is death. And so it's a very interesting thing, and I want to say this very carefully, that what we've come to see is that all of our fears of death have to come from life experiences. That is, since we have no experience of death, we have no fear that can go with the experience of death. The fear that we talk about when we talk about fearing death is fear that comes from the experience of life. So the fears of death are really fears that come out of the experience of life. For example, one of my fears when I think about death is separation from my loved ones. I don't want to be separated from the ones I love. But what I began to realize, and I especially realized this 4 or 5 years ago, I was taking John Jr. down to the airport and put him on an airplane to go to Austin to see his sister. And I remember walking down the airport walkway there, thinking that, oh my God, if, you know, hope nothing happens to him. If anything happened to that little boy, I would go to Mexico and drink for the rest of my life. And I hadn't thought about taking a drink in years. I'm into my 18th year of sobriety, and I suddenly said to myself, you know, what's the matter? What am I doing this for? Where is this coming from? And it dawned on me that, you know, how great this attachment was, and that this fear of separation had to do with an unhealthy attachment, and that out of some of the conflict and pain with my own father, that I had set up a kind of relationship with my son that was not healthy for him or me. And the last few years have been really, I've really worked hard at becoming non-attached to him. I'm not sure at all that I've got that completely squared away, but certainly part of the process has been done. And another one of my fears of death is the process of dying, the process of being helpless with bedpans and having to be taken care of and my bodily functions having to be taken care of. And yet I realize as I think about that, that basically is an issue of my life. That I grew up in a religious tradition that had was highly colored by a Manichaean streak, which meant the body and matter were given bad press and the body was not good. And therefore, for years, I've never been comfortable with my body, with my bodily functions. I laughingly have shared with you of going over to people's house and using their bathroom and turning on the water so no one heard what I was doing in there. And all of that is a non-acceptance of bodily function, of my animality as a part of me. So my fear, that fear that goes with that dying, is a fear of life. Also the fear of helplessness, of being taken care of. I hate to put people out. I hate to be a burden. And what I understand is that I have a very severe problem with receiving, the giving and receiving, that I'm a great giver, but I'm not a good receiver. And that it's been very, very important for me for the last years to work on accepting from people and receiving and being out of control and letting go of the control. Because when I'm receiving from somebody, I'm letting go of the control. So you see, what's in it for me, as I look at these fears of death, what I'm really understanding are my fears of life and what is blocking me from fully living my life. And that's what's in it for you, the understanding that if you deny death, if you keep this denial going, if you don't look at it squarely, if you don't understand that it's by facing these fears that we can understand something profound about living our life. The little girl said she, as she was dying, she was living more fully than ever before. So this living our life is important, is the crucial issue. And what we understand about dying and what's up for us today in owning my personal death is that what really has to happen is I have to grieve. I have to go through the process of grieving. And the process of grieving is grieving for me. I am the one who is going to die, my own finitude. So what each one of us has to do in accepting our own personal death as we get through the denials and understand that the fears of death are the fears of life, then we have to accept our dying, and that means grieving for ourselves. And that's real interesting to me. As we did that exercise last week, I had you go to a safe place and meditate and see your death coming toward you. And I asked you to look at that picture of your death and see how your death appeared to you, in what form it took. And I asked you to talk to your death, and I asked you to hear your death telling you that you had 6 months to live, and to focus on the good things about your life, what you liked about your life, and what you also didn't like about it. What was the great accomplishment of your life so far, and what do you still want to do, and what are you going to do with those next 6 months? And I asked you to see somebody then, see your death go away, and see someone you love come to you, and then talk to that person about what you're going to do. And that meditation is very, very powerful, and it can help you to live your life beautifully. And to live our lives beautifully, we've got to understand that life is this process, that we have to be good dyers, we have to be good grievers, we have to know how to say goodbye. And that what it really constitutes in owning my death is grieving for myself. And the most important aspect about grieving, well, there are two major things about it. One is the aspect of working through all the business that I need to finish, working through the resentments in the past or giving up the past. The thing that keeps grieving going is the unfinished business. We've got to know that grieving goes through stages and that there is unfinished business, and we've got to get the business finished. One of the real powerful statements that I want to read to you is about a man whose wife was dying. And this is what he wrote. He said, Eve had been dying for 3 months now, and I was exhausted and furious. Every morning I woke up furious. I dreaded the day. I dreaded seeing her. All of my anger just stared me in the face. It was always there, like a huge block between us. I'd been angry with Eve for a very long time. And there she was now, in front of me, dying. I felt like she was getting back at me. I was terrified of my feelings. I was terrified of what I might be doing to her, but it was there anyway, like a boulder between us. It stopped anything nice from happening. Every day we just looked at each other blankly. So finally one day I sat down near her and I just cried. It was all too much. I cried and I cried. I knew she was frightened, but I told her, I'm sorry, Eve, but I'm so angry with you. And I'm so frightened, too, and oh, God, I'm so frightened. Then, thank God, she started crying, too. It felt so good, the both of us crying. It was really a great relief to me. Before, she just lay there like a clay statue. At least she was crying now. At least she was alive. And I took her in my arms, and I hugged her. And for the first time, I could really hug her, and I could really feel how much she meant to me. See, the very act of telling someone that we're angry or frightened by them, this very act is an act of love and appreciation. The other person knows it anyway. It's impossible not to be moved when someone's being truthful. It's impossible not to feel loved. So this thing of being honest and being honest with your anger and expressing your anger. I bet you some of you have gone, you know about your relatives that you go up to and you kiss them and your lips just sort of purse, and there's your jaws locked, and you know about that experience. There's some block there. There's some piece of unfinished business. There's something that you haven't done yet that needs to be done. Suppose you're angry anyway. Think of all the relatives you got that you go up and kiss, and your mouth sticks. I can guarantee you who you're clear with and who you're not clear with. Are hugs. See, there's full body hugs, and then there's pushing your butt back hugs, and there's breastplate of armor hugs. And when you are clear with someone, you just flow. You just flow. The kissing will flow, and your bodies will flow. But when you're angry, if there's conflict, those lips will purse up. Because, see, the way you stop yourself from feeling is through muscle tension. Tensing antagonistic muscles. And so the problem of holding that anger, remember, anger is an emotion, E-motion. It's an energy in motion. It's an energy. So if you repress the energy, you're stuffing molecules in there. And it's building a wall so that you can't get through it. So here's this woman dying and she's blocked from talking to her loved one. And he's blocked from talking to her because he's scared and frightened. And he's probably, like millions of us, got this crazy be nice. See, if you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all. So this guy's pissed, sitting by his dying wife. And he's probably got this tape that says, if you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all. So they're blocked. And if he didn't do this, she would die alone without any communication with him. So expressing that anger becomes an act of love. You see, love is built and grows out of honesty, not out of pretense. You can't pretend like you're loving and create love. You can't play act loving and build love. You have to be honest. Because what honesty does is builds trust. If you tell me the truth, I'm angry at you, when I knew it anyway, then I don't feel so alone. I don't feel so crazy. I don't feel so abandoned. At least I know where you're coming from. And you're being honest with me, and I begin to trust you. That you will tell me when you're angry. But suppose I know that you must be angry, but you never say it. You say, it's all right. Oh, no, it's okay.
Don't worry. Oh, no, I don't mind. You blew up the kitchen. It's okay. Yeah. We have this mild problem. She has three boyfriends and sleeps with all three of them. I had a guy tell me that in therapy one time. Never wavered. I mean, my God. You know, that man was so enraged, his colon had 16 holes in it. But that's where it goes, you see. If you don't get it out here, it comes out there. It's got to go somewhere. See, so falseness and lies are often experienced by the other person. Being nice, when you know the other person doesn't feel that way. Telling the truth, and the truth will make you free. Now, don't go to work tomorrow and do this. I really want to be careful about being responsible about this. You know, where it is appropriate to be honest and build love. Generally, offices are not the place to build love. They're a place where we get our economic needs met and we try to make it as compatible as we can. But don't go in there and open up to your boss. Tell him you always thought he was a shit. I mean, that doesn't work, folks. So don't say Bradshaw said go open up. Because you're going to get fired if you do that. But there is an appropriate way to, you know, the people that you love, the people that you care about, the people that are important to you, to be able to go to them and share where you really are. And this is very difficult. Anger has been the hardest thing in my whole life to deal with. It is also the place that I'm the most phony. It is the place that I'm the most phony. It's the place that I'm the most dishonest. Because, see, when I express anger, it scares me. I have hallucinations about it. And it was one of the seven deadly sins growing up. And so when anger comes, my body trembles and my lip quivers. And, oh, man, it's really something. But what I'm finding is that to go through the discomfort is a more loving act than not to do it because of my own comfort. You see, I'm not being nice for you. I'm being nice because I don't want to deal with the discomfort of conflict. You see how self-centered that is? And we can act like we're so loving and so caring and so kind. But we're not. We're really doing it for ourselves. It's the old ego rearing his ugly head again. That I don't want to deal with that discomfort. Because I have phobic and catastrophic fantasies about anger. No one will ever love me again. You couldn't love me if I expressed anger to you. And I would say that the place that most of us are the most wounded, the two feelings that are the most important in life, one is to preserve the species, sexual feelings. One is self-preservation, angry feelings. Those are the two most repressed. Now think about it. Go back to your families of origin and think about whether you could express those two feelings. And that is really crazy. And when Camus and those people write about the absurd and the absurdity, and we go, oh, isn't that silly rhinoceros multiplying on a stage? Ionesco's plays. Ionesco is just looking at us going, you're just as weird. You repress the life-preserving feeling of sex, and you repress the life-preserving feeling of anger. And you're taught to do that and rewarded for it with grace. And that's crazy. So it's so important in doing your grieving to deal with your anger. Now, the interesting thing about grieving is that it's been studied, and we now understand that it's a process, and it has to be done. Freud, one of his most famous papers was called Mourning and Melancholia. And it was a woman who was diagnosed as an involutional melancholic. Whatever that means. But what that means is, it was a woman who went into periods of depression quite predictably, somewhat every year at the same time. And there is some evidence that this has a genetic, organic factor to it, but there's also evidence that it could be some other cause. And what Freud found in the analysis with this woman is that the time of her depression exactly matched the time of her mother's dying. After her mother's death, she began this melancholia. And Freud worked it through with her, and as he worked through the grieving with her, the melancholia went away. What he came to do was to call the work that he did with this woman the grief work. And he felt that he had discovered something very important, that the psyche has to go through this work. Now, this is crucial to all of us, because I just talked about life is dying, or another way to say it, life is grieving. In order to grow, I have to die. In order to die, I have to say goodbye. In order to say goodbye, I have to leave the familiar and go to the unfamiliar. I leave toddlerhood and infancy. I leave the womb. I go to infancy. I leave infancy. I start walking. I go through the terrible twos. I go through holding on and letting go. Then I go into imagination. I go through the period of identification sexually. I go through a terrible dying, going to school. Little Farquhar leaves home at 5. And at home, he was little Mr. Wonderful. They have his spit cast in bronze on the dining room. Little Farquhar, but little Farquhar is a brat. The teacher looks at little Farquhar and says, look at this little brat. The teacher doesn't like little Farquhar at all. And man, this is a rude awakening for this kid. Suddenly the world has changed and he's got to renegotiate and he wants to go home. He doesn't want to go to school. And then there's all these other kids and some of them are mean to him. And he has social adjustments. And he just gets that all right about 6th, 7th grade, and then he has to go to high school or junior high school. And then he's nobody again. He has to make another passage. And see, all this involves grieving and loss and saying goodbye and being born again. And then high school, he longs for the day when he can be a senior. Then he's going to have power and potency in the summer of 42. And the American graffiti. And then he graduates. I'll never forget that. I'll never forget the Coliseum walking with my cap and gown. And I remember some people applauded and they weren't supposed to. And so Dana, who was an Italiano woman, when Joe walked up, she got all the Italians in the audience to clap for Joe. So they'd clap louder than my people clapped for me. But those were wonderful things. And then I said goodbye to those people, and some of those people I've never seen ever again. You think that's impossible. And then I went to college, and it all begins again. It's always a process of saying goodbye. Buddha's first noble truth was that life was suffering. Suffering in the sense that we're always saying goodbye. We're always leaving the familiar. We're always leaving the trapeze bars if you want to get to the other side. And the space between is what's scary. So you say goodbye to the 20s. You say goodbye to the 30s. You say goodbye to the 40s. You say goodbye to the 50s. You say goodbye to the 60s. And all of life is saying goodbye. All of life is dying and being born. All of life is grieving. Those who know how to live well know how to grieve well. You understand that? So the process of grieving becomes crucial. And what Freud is telling us, that you have to go through various emotions. Then Erich Lindemann at Massachusetts General Hospital in 1944 was brought into the survivors of the Coconut Grove fire. Hundreds of people had died. Many people had been burned. Some people were getting well and some weren't. And Lindemann's team was called in to find out why these people weren't getting well. They weren't healing. And they had been burned equally as to these other people who were healing. Lindemann began to examine the people who were getting well, and then once he did that, he compared the people who weren't getting well, and what he found was the people who weren't getting well were not grieving. They were all denying. They were denying. They were staying in denial. They wouldn't let themselves think of their husbands or wives. They wouldn't deal with their regrets. They wouldn't deal with even the good memories of their loved ones. They weren't doing the grief work. So Lindemann began to work with these people, and he came out with a whole typography of what people have to do to grieve. And interestingly enough, About 10 years, 15, 20 years later, Kubler-Ross began working with dying people and suddenly came out with the same stages. Because what's happening when people are dying and they know it? They're grieving for themselves. So the same process takes place. Now what I want to tell you in terms of owning your own death and owning your own life, there is a grieving that needs to be done. And I just want to offer this guideline that going through the acceptance of my own personal death, personally appropriating it, and I mean existentially appropriating it. I don't mean that I talk about it in the abstract. I mean I get the ego chill that comes from feeling and thinking about my own death. That I go through denial, that I go through anger, that I go through remorse, that I go through guilt. And you see, if you're dealing with this meditation I gave you last week, that is a way to work on your grieving. Your death comes to you. You have only a certain amount of time to live. What are you happy about? What are you unhappy about? Who are you unfinished with? And don't wait till tomorrow. You can go call somebody right now. You can turn to your wife or husband on the way home and tell them you love them if that's unfinished. Or go home and tell them you're angry and you need to talk to them if that's unfinished. If you're pretending, work on completing these relationships. The greatest blessing in my life, I've said this 100 times, was that I had done these courses 4 or 5 times before my father died. And I was able to hold him in my arms and ask him if he was afraid. I was able to say to him, "You are dying, Daddy. Are you scared?" I held him, I talked to him, I told him I loved him. And I had very little unfinished. The only piece of unfinished I had was that they pulled the plug on his machine with the tracheotomy, and we were all downstairs, and they shushed me out of that room in the last 30 minutes when he died, and I would beat that nurse up right now if I could do that over again. That's the only piece of it, that she rushed all the people that love him out of that room while he died. And, you know, it's just outrageous when I think about it, but I was too upset. I was dealing with my sister, and I was dealing with my brother and myself, and so that's the only piece I had to work through. And, it's a piece that you can work through just so much. But now when I say work through, I mean I had accepted my own death so I could be there with my daddy. Well, let me tell you something. If you haven't accepted your death, remember Andrea? I quoted Andrea to you last day. Andrea is the one who wrote to her mother this beautiful statement, in my opinion, which really focuses on what this series is about. She said, "Dear Mother, even as I am dying, I'm living. I know you won't understand that. I know you will still think I'm strange. And now that I look thin and yellow, if you look at me from the outside, I probably look quite ugly to you. But from the inside, Mother, I feel beautiful. I feel bigger and bigger every moment, as if I'm going to burst out of this body and enter into another skin. Soon the whole universe will be my body. I'm living more, Mother, as I'm dying each day. I'm growing into something amazing. I wonder if you can understand that." See, and that's a question I've put to myself. Because that's what this series is about, helping us all to understand that the living and the dying go together. And that as I accept my dying, I accept my living, I live more. I live more fully. I live more fully because today is the time to do it. Today's the time to love somebody. Today's the time to finish the relationships or get them straight. Not tomorrow. It comes like a thief. You need to prepare for it. And the other thing is that we've got to... The more I have dealt with my own dying, the more I can love the person who is dying and let them be. Now listen to Andrea again. "Dear Mother, you feel you have a right to hold on to me the way you are doing and to demand everything. You feel we are bound by some invisible bond that I, for one, never agreed to. We're welded by some unspeakable tie. I do not want to be welded to you. I do not want to miss you. I do not want to look in your eyes. It is harder and harder for me to have to pretend and say that I love you. If you really loved me, leave me alone. Please do not bring me any more candy. Now, this is hard for us to grasp what this girl is going through. What she's going through is that her mother hasn't dealt with her own death, so she's possessing her. She is possessing her. She won't let her die. Many people won't let other people grieve. The hardest thing I deal with in grieving clients is that their friends won't let them grieve. When they want to talk about the one that died that they loved 6 months, 9 months, a year later, when they want to cry a little bit with their friends, the friends won't let them.
The friends will say, well, I think it's about time you were getting that cleared up, Martha. Don't you think you're holding on this a little too long?
And why? Why is a friend doing that? Because they don't want to deal with it. They don't want to deal with what that conjures up. The pain that it brings, the discomfort of dealing with my own death. See, death is loss. Where are you with that? Another part of grieving, and I'll just touch on this briefly, though. Another part of grieving is, what are you going to lose when you die? What are you going to miss? What are the things? What are your possessions? What is it that you hold on to? What are you willing to give away? A little meditation. You know, just close your eyes and think of someone you love. What are you willing to give them? What do you want in return from them? What will you give them and feel like you are still yourself? What do you want from them in return? What do you feel you have to hold on to be you? What do you want back from the person? What are you willing to ask for? But then what can I lose and still be me? If I lost my house in Minnesota, am I still me? If I lost my Cadillac, my green Cadillac, am I still me? Who am I? You see, some people identify with the objects of their possessions, and death is much harder then. Much, much harder. Because if you are your possessions, then you're going to lose them all. Remember, when your friend dies, you lose a friend. When you die, you lose every friend. You lose everything. Where are you with loss and attachments? This is part of grieving. What do you have to have? Do you have to have money to be okay? Do you have to have Mercedes to be okay? Do you have to have prestige to be okay? Do you have to have fine silks to be okay? Who are you? See, these are the questions that this can get to rather radically. Where are you with attachments? And the Easterns are right. Our pain is from our attachments. And when I looked at dying, my fears were losing all I had worked for. But you see, I will never lose what's most important to me, my inner self, because that's something that cannot come from the outside. Now, in 2 weeks, I'm going to talk about that. I'm going to talk about that, looked at as a natural event, death and birth are the two things that happen to you without choice. But looked at from another point of view, death is the greatest choice you have. It's the most complete choice you have. It will be the final act and decision that, if you accept it, will be the fullest, most creative choice that you ever made. And so when Jesus dies, remember, God's way of redemption was to have Jesus die the death. And what I told you the first lecture is that the most difficult theological question I know was, why did Almighty God choose death as the vehicle of redemption? Is there some deep metaphysical truth and theological truth that can come out of the realization that of all the possible modes of redemption, Almighty God chose that Jesus Christ would die the death of the cross? What is there in the nature of death as death that makes that the brilliance, if you will, the apex of the divine plan? And what I'm going to suggest to you is that it is only at death that you are free. It is only at death where you have the full range of total human freedom and the fullest choice possible. And it's only at death that you are in the ultimate meeting. And it's only at death where you've gotten it right with God, because all of our life we keep trying to possess God too. Wherever you are with your attachments and possessions, take a look at that with God. God is the one who cannot be possessed.
God is the one who cannot be possessed. It bothers me when people know they're saved and tell everyone else how to be saved, because that's having God as a possession. It's like, I have God as a possession. You can never have that. It will always be some darkness and fear and trembling until the final act. Now, that's what we have to look at. Is death a natural event? See, the Christian position is that it is not. And what I told you the first day is that phenomenologically, we all believe that. The first response to death is, you've got to be kidding. Not Mary, not Jane, not Joe. You're kidding. Oh, no. We don't think it's a natural event. It supposedly is. Look around you. Death is happening all the time. But people are enraged by death. The wages of sin is death, the Bible says. The Christian position, which I told you was utterly unique, says that death is not natural. That's what we have to look at. Lots of things to think about.